Ah, you dickheads.
And welcome to Double Dodge, episode 19. This one, I think we're calling Raiders of the Lost Tapes. And with me today is my good friend Dave. Dave, how are you, sir?
I'm glad we're still friends.
We are. It's amazing. We keep doing it. We keep playing Guild Ball and we're still friends.
Wow.
Mm.
Indeed. It's a testament to your fortitude, I think.
And is there a reason why we're calling this Raiders of the Lost Tapes?
Well, Campbell, funny you should ask that. This episode was plagued by technical difficulties. And the episode, we're chatting with Matt Hart in quite a lot of detail for this episode. The first time we recorded with him, we lost about an hour's worth of audio. So that was obviously deeply distressing. We gave him a call back, and he was very kind to give us another hour, and we had a good chat with him. So it's split into two lots of interviews with Matt. We've got the first 30 minutes of the initial one. We've got a carball that looks at... basically, we tested out the new deployment rules for Guild Ball, and then we jump back on the phone with Matt and have a chat about a range of things, including the alternate deployment, how that's been playing out over the last few weeks. I guess his broad thoughts about life, about natural cocaine tea, about the new Warband game that Steamforge has under wraps.
He gave us quite a bit of information there, and it's testament to them that he actually, you know, found time for us. I think he was about to go away on holiday in the next day or two. But knowing that, you know, obviously we'd lost audio, he was more than happy to jump back on and really, you know, help us out. But it also obviously helps plug their product as well. So, no, it was awesome that he could do that.
Yeah, so this one's a bit longer. I think it's a bit over 2 hours just to take into account the interruption in the usual publishing cycle. So get amongst it.
And find out, you know. Well, it's actually interesting because of that new deployment rules. We've actually, the first recording was pre that, and then you and I played some, and then we actually discuss a bit more about it. So Matt does go into a bit of detail about the feedback they've got on the forums, and I think that's quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, I think it all fits thematically. So even though we were very sad to lose what was actually some pretty great audio, it has worked out for the best in terms of giving us a coherent theme for the episode.
Did you actually, during the editing, discover something fascinating about some of Matt's vocal tics and the audio wave profile?
Yes, Campbell. Funnily enough, every time Matt says, and believe me, he says it a lot, it looks like a fucking stegosaurus. Mm. And I have grown to hate those fucking stegosauruses. Mm-hmm. I love Matt.
Yeah. Well, at least it wasn't like, you know, a Plesiadapus or anything like that.
No, it's not like not like a Diplodocus, right?
Okay. That's fine. Yeah. That's fine.
Fucking stego, no. Man.
Fascinating the things you learn when doing a podcast, really.
Indeed.
One of the other things we have got going, and we'll do a shout-out now for it, is we, being unoriginal people, have decided to start a Patreon account. And this is really just to help basically pay for some of the costs that are involved in actually doing a podcast. We still do it for the love. It's not about us trying to make millions of dollars, although if you want to pledge millions of dollars, I'll find a way of putting that up there. So if you want to help us out and, you know, throw us a couple of bucks, we've got three different pledge levels of $1, $5, and $10, and this is per month. We were lucky enough to have four people jump on already, just based off Dave posting it on Twitter. Fuck knows how we've got four people following us on Twitter still. But we got Mr. Jared McGraw. Mate, you're wasting your money. I don't know why you even bothered like spending money on us. Kevin Stewart, Max Beck, and it just comes up as Andrew from Singled Out. I don't know who the fuck that guy is. He must be part of some...
Oh, I've heard things about that guy. Bad things. You know, terrible things.
You've got to get into single digits in podcasting before you can, you know, start supporting other people.
Now, I'm pretty sure Kevin Stewart runs Guild Ball Zone. I am pretty sure.
I think you might be correct. Yes. Yeah.
So. Check that out. He's got a great Discord server channel, the Gilball Zone Discord server channel, also known affectionately by Australians as the Gilball Zone Wank Dungeon.
Mm.
They actually, it's pretty good. They talk about a lot of stuff in there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I often get a notification. I'll go on and just see. Yeah. Interesting conversations that people are having, and you know, floating ideas about models. So,
fucking Botsy's always in there, man. He's like,
Botsy,
I'm Botsy.
Yeah, yeah. but the Patreon channel, I should say this before we go, is patreon.com/double dodge, just in case you're wondering who the fuck we were. Yes, it's not that hard. Jump on there. It's like, you know, the $5 a month would be awesome, $1 a month would be just as good. Whatever you want to throw at us, it'd be great. We actually. For the 5 and the 10, you get a widget, and the 10, you actually get a widget and stubby holder. We send them out to you at our cost. So,
yep. So anything is greatly appreciated. And thank you to those people who have already subscribed. We are deeply grateful. Thank you.
Absolutely.
This is a bit of a behemoth, Campbell, so I think we best get started.
Let's cut it short before any more stegosauruses come along.
So our guest tonight needs no introduction, but we're going to give him one anyway. He's been absent from the podcasting landscape for some time, but Campbell, the ever stalwart adventurer that he is, has braved the deepest, darkest depths of Stockport to retrieve him from the opium den in which he was slumbering. The one, the only, the Stockport strangler himself, Matt Hart. How are you, Matt?
I'm very good, although I worry about the residents of Stockport being labelled with my presence. I'm a London boy. I come from Essex.
I mean, it does fuck our narrative a bit. We'll just roll with it. We'll roll with it.
Just a little bit. I mean, you can call me the Essex Strangler if you want, but... you know. at least half the statement would then be accurate.
Yeah, we're not big on accuracy here on Double Dutch. I don't know if you've noticed. We like to sort of blur the line between truth and fiction.
Sounds good. Everything else is all fine. It's just the Stockport bit that I kind of take exception to.
Yeah, I don't know. The Essex Strangler doesn't have quite the same ring to it.
It doesn't sound nearly as infamous. It's much more commonplace. We're a tougher breed down south, I tell you. I mean, the thing is, when you're the other side of the planet in a fairly big country like yours, although I did find out that, is it something like 95% of your landmass is just basically unpopulated apart from dingoes and blokes with no teeth?
Yeah.
That's about it, yeah.
And bears with bodies in them.
Yeah. So the interior is not dark, but it's certainly vast.
I think it's the opposite. The trouble is the interior is so bloody bright with sunshine that no one wants to live there.
Yeah.
I lived in Australia a long time ago, and one of my abiding memories was having to go out with my dad on a Saturday morning, and my job was to get like a bamboo cane and lift the funnel webs, trap doors up so he could like squirt a bit of light fluid in, drop a match in, kill the buggers.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. And we had to do that Saturday morning before we were allowed to play on the lawn.
That's quality Australian upbringing. I like that.
He sounds like a good dad.
Well, he didn't want us to die from being hit by a funnel web, I suppose, but which, yeah, probably puts him in the category of good dad.
Yeah, it's, I mean, look, admittedly, it's a low bar, but it's, we're glad you made it through. We're glad you survived your childhood, Matt.
I survived it just, yeah. Some kid brought a funnel web into school once. I remember that as well.
We've got a property down south from here. I caught my he was 8 at the time. He's 10 now. Capturing redback spiders.
Wow.
And he brought one over. Yeah, yeah. And he was actually quite calm with it too.
He's like, look at this. You're like, do you know how deadly that is? No, not at all.
Yeah. Well, someone's going to die here, and it's not going to be
safe. Australia, everything's deadly.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
Yeah, we at least buy into the mythology. So yeah, it's nice that you can. I mean, it is actually our federal government's major deterrent of illegal immigration.
Is it all propaganda? It's not true.
Yeah, it's
all they do is just cuddle you. They don't really want to chew your face off.
Man, lots of friendly animals. Speaking of friendly animals, I think we wanted to get you on because not only have you been, I guess, observing radio silence for such a long time, but we were worried, man. We were worried.
Well, I appreciate your concern.
You know, we're looking out for you. But there has been many exciting developments in the world of Steamforged, and it seems like a really good opportunity to catch up and actually have a chat about them.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I know that Campbell is, like, bursting at the seams, you know, back from the recovery mission, just a bunch of questions he wants to ask. So I think he's taking point on this one.
Yeah. I think I've got about three questions, so we'll see how long Matt can go for. But, I think to start with, I just wanted to get an idea of, what you've been up to in terms of game development. And, we've seen a quick post, I think it was today, with one of the your new branching little projects. But, I just wanted to get a bit of an idea of what's Matt been doing.
Mm. So it's certainly true that we've not been going on as many podcasts as we once were, largely because we had a bit of a reshuffle in the marketing stroke media stroke community kind of team, and I'm a huge fan. If you don't know what to say, then the best thing to say is nothing. So we were kind of trying to get all our ducks in a row to make sure that we're working efficiently as a team, because what we'd found is there was a lot of different methods of kind of getting in touch with people at Steamforged, and it felt a little bit incoherent insofar as some people would know us on Facebook, some people would know us on Twitter, some people would use emails. So what we've been doing behind the scenes is basically putting a bit of structure into the marketing team and the community team to make sure everyone understands what it is we're trying to do, and just try and make sure that we're all pulling in the same direction, because I think one of the things that's really important is that, the people who play Guild Ball feel that they're part of the process and they're not confused by the messages that come out of Steamforged. And when you're running, a team across many locations of the size of the team that we're running, it can be very easy for miscommunications quite inadvertently to occur. So a lot of what we've done the last couple of months is really just getting the right people in the right place with the right plan that ties in with how we're going to go about doing things. And it's just coincided with, the natural kind of peaks and troughs of a game's life cycle. You look at any game that's out there, and it goes through periods of intense excitement, and then things kind of just flatten off for a little while, and then something happens and it gets all spiked up again and everyone's super excited and interested again, and it's entirely natural. And I think it's just as you expand and consolidate and expand and consolidate on a game or on a team or on a company, it's all part of life, right? So what we've seen over the last couple of months behind the scenes is like a huge amount of kind of infrastructure consolidation, if you want a management buzzword or buzz phrase. What it basically means is we're getting our shit together and we know what we're going to do and how we're marching forward, and and everyone's singing from the same song sheet now.
Nice. So in that, and you're talking about the kind of peaks and troughs, where do you think Guild Ball's kind of at the moment in terms of the development and the refinement?
So as Guild Ball expands, it becomes a more and more complicated beast, and certainly as we develop it, we learn more and more about the game as developers, as well as players. I mean, all of the people in the development team, we still play Guild Ball at least two or three times a week, casually, not just as part of our jobs. And we just get more and more understanding of the game. And, you learn from lessons. Like, we are not perfect. We're human beings. And some of the stuff that we do seems like a great idea at the time. And then with the benefit of hindsight, you think, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. How can we go about A, not doing it again, and B, trying to correct it? And you guys have already seen that we're not scared of putting out erratas, to try and maintain the health of the game and the balance of the game. And, ostensibly what we want is everyone who plays Guild Ball, regardless of the team you have, to feel like you've got a chance of winning the game. And Guild Ball is, it should be a game of player skill, not the fact that you've got the most OP team and you're going to ruffle stomp people just because you're playing, I don't know, whatever the flavor of the month is, Alchemist or Fish or whatever. It should be, you know, I pick these models because they suit my playstyle. I like the way they look. I enjoy painting them. And, you know, with practice, I've got quite good at them. That should be the feeling that we're trying to, you know, get everyone to feel when they're involved in the Guild Ball.
Nice. So as far as that kind of development goes, you you obviously feel like you're in a decent kind of sweet spot. Are there any new changes that, you know, are on the horizon or things that you feel need, you know, tweaking?
So what we've got is we've obviously got the core game and the core, you know, and that kind of central experience that everyone knows and understands. And the temptation is for us to tinker with it and try new things. And but we don't want to do that to necessarily the core game. So what we're looking to do is use things like the OP document and perhaps hold on a second. My dog is digging in the garden. I'm going to bang on the window.
This is not getting edited out. This is staying.
No. This is standard media training. Do you think they're like, you
know, this is on page 27. Get out of the garden.
Yeah, blame the dog. When you don't answer a question, blame the dog.
Fucking
Jamie P does this to us all the fucking time.
Anyway, what's the next question? No, so basically, we've got Guild Ball's really at a precipice now of some really exciting stuff coming down the track. We've got I nearly launched into the full release schedule, which I obviously can't do, but I can do in certain ways. But there's a load of new developments coming out that's going to, you know, expand the options that Guild Ball players have. We're also looking at the way the game is actually being played. And one of the things we're constantly aware of and internally we're tinkering with is the state of the game's health, not just in terms of the balance of the models, but actually what is the meta? How are people playing it? And one of the things you guys would have seen in our last kind of tweak was at that time, melee heavy teams or takeout teams were quite strong in the ascendancy, and it became quite unpopular for people to even play with the ball. And, you know, you have guys advocating that you should just kill the ball as far back as you possibly can and then just beat your opponent to pulp. And you're thinking, well, I'm thinking like, well, you might as well play any other game at that point. Guild Ball is a game of football. So what can we do to kind of, you know, lift the football-y side of things a little bit higher in the meta and make that a lot more relevant to the game that's being played, obviously without skewing it so far that takeouts are largely pointless. So that was, you know, one of the tweaks that we kind of did. And one of the things I'm seeing now is there's a degree of spatial control between teams, and you end up with quite a lot of early, certainly in the early turns, like turns one and two, like a lot of kind of conservative style play. Which actually slows the game down. I don't know if you guys have noticed it, but you know, you play games like this and you end up 45, 50 minutes into a game and no one's really done anything. And you're like, well, no one's scored anything, no one's done anything. And then suddenly as a flurry, it all happens. And you think, well, that back end bit, that last like 30 minutes where we scored like 20 victory points between us, that was cool. That bit leading up to it was a bit, you know, not as cool. It was like just jockeying and posturing for position and stuff like that. Now, these things are like super important, but what I want to try and do is kind of concentrate those down. So, you know, we've been thinking about stuff like that and coming up with a few ideas. And I know Jamie's going to be putting up a blog post, because I think one of the things that would be interesting for people to see is to be a part of the process. So, you know, we've got a load of ideas that we obviously have been working on internally. One of them is getting to the point where it's actually worth sharing with everyone. So, you know, almost like a bit of a field test, like, you know, hey, what do you think? This is something we think is brilliant and we're really enjoying playing with this internally. We'd like to kind of get, you know, a temperature gauge from what you guys think. And what this is one of the lessons that we've learned is, you know, we have a small experienced development team. We have a large experienced playtest group. But even with those kind of assets, you know, there is a finite number of games and that we can actually play before we release products, however diligent we are. and that number is far, far smaller than the first day of release when it hits, you know, 10,000 Guild Ball players, and suddenly 20,000 games of Guild Ball have been played within a couple of days, and someone will always find the, well, you didn't think of this, did you? Look at this thing, and you're like, oh, God, yeah, we didn't think of that. So what we're learning from that is actually some of these things that change the flow of the game, not necessarily the balance of the models, but the flow of the game, how the game actually feels to play, we would get a lot of benefit out of people trying it out earlier and letting us know the feedback of what they think and being a part of the process. And then we'll work out how we're going to deploy it. Do we do it via, you know, an OP update? Do we do it as an alternative format? Do we, you know, if it's supremely successful, which I think that, you know, the thing that Jamie's working on right now has real potential to be as successful as I think it's going to be. Could even find its way into the core game, say season 4. You know, if we find that it really makes the game better.
Nice. So, can you, given that I'm assuming this is going to launch pretty soon, and our podcast probably won't launch for a few days because Dave's got to do a fair bit of cocaine between now and then. That you can give us an idea as to what that idea or development is.
Yeah. So
in terms of the spatial play.
Yeah. So what if if you imagine a Guild Ball pitch, you have the halfway line, you have the current deployment line, and then you have the goal line, yeah, which is 6, 10, and 18 inches from your back edge, effectively. And what we're saying is, as you pick your team, you're drafting your teams, you're actually placing them down, you're deploying them at the point of which you're picking them. Now, the stipulation is that two of your models need to be touching the gold line, two of your models need to be touching the current deployment line, and two of your models need to be touching the halfway line. There is a 3 or 4 inch exclusion zone around models, so you can't start engaged with another model. But what you've got is you basically got two models, you know, who are right up there, and so is your opponent. And then you've got two models who are kind of a little bit further back than normal, and then two who are in the usual spot. So generally, the guy who's kicking the ball is the guy who's on the deployment, your standard deployment line. So he kind of moves up, boots the ball forward, and in theory, you've got potential of 3 against 2, but your opponent's moving first, so they can also bring someone up. And what we found is the game kind of is engaged, like the teams are engaged literally from the first whistle. And it creates an awful lot of opportunities for kind of tactical play through the deployment phase, because you're doing alternate deployments. So do you get bold and stick your captain down on the center spot and try and control that central sort of 3 or 4 inch bubble, but run the risk of, you know, getting double teamed, or do you hold him back, or, you know, which models do you put on the back line because they're like 4 inches back from everyone or 2 inches back from everyone else? Do you put faster models there and try and get them up into the gameplay a lot quicker, but you generally want those guys up front because they're going to be normally they're a good goal threat. There's a lot of additional kind of strategic thought that goes into how you actually deploy it. But the long and short of it is, both teams end up, dare I say, exposed to each other. Like you're already kind of in the thick of a game. So there is no kind of holding a line back, like 1 inch outside your deployment, you know, waiting for the first person to blink, and then the game kind of descends into chaos from that point.
Oh, I really like that. Did that develop from, I know you love your positional play and, you know, certain traits that allow, you know, charges for one less influence, that kind of thing. Did it develop from that, or was it mainly to do with that posturing for position, threat range kind of measuring?
So there's a couple of factors. So
Jump in? Because as soon as you said, you know, on the halfway line, I'm imagining having wingers or strikers on the halfway line, but on each side, or, you know, if you haven't got that strong center, and all of a sudden it's really stretching out your team and playing very positionally.
Exactly. So one of the things that I think is important for Guild Ball is basically spreading the play, but also having that attraction to concentrate in the play. So for me, that kind of dilemma of is it, based on the current game state, is it correct for me to try and spread the play, or is it correct for me to try and concentrate the play? should be part of the enjoyable kind of thinking process behind playing a game of Guild Ball. And what we found is obviously concentrating the players is quite an efficient way of playing the game. You end up scrumming up in the middle, and it feels like, you know, but when you spread the play, the game feels a lot more open and a lot more things happen. And so the game's a lot more exciting as a result of it. So this is where we started thinking about, you know, the positioning style abilities that encourage certain models to be, you know, closer to the wings, for example, or within a distance of a goal. And it was largely to kind of encourage and help people understand what good positioning means for particular kinds of models. So it's almost like a love letter from the design team to players old and new that, hey, you know, veteran Brisket, she's pretty good when she's off by the side because you get this ability. So that's a kind of cool place to play her. But obviously, you know, without actually forcing you to do so. So it's kind of an extension of that in many ways, that it does give you that sense of an attacking line, a midfield and a defensive line. And I think it kind of opens up a lot of thought process as to, you know, well, if I've got to put a guy by the goal, should I just put a goal, you know, is a goalkeeper model a good idea, or should I bring another striker style model who's super fast and they can kind of catch up with the play a lot quicker? That's kind of the entomology of it, is just to kind of, one, stretch to play, two, you know, use a lot more of the board, and three, add another layer of just thinking about where you're going to position your models and make the game get to turn two faster, basically.
Have you found does it speed up the game time? Because I imagine, I mean, so yeah. Dave and I played in a final against each other a month or so ago, and all the points were scored, barring probably 4 points, were in the last 10 minutes of the game easily.
Yep.
Has it shortened the game time?
Yep. No, it accelerates you through that first third of the game. Doesn't eliminate it altogether, but it certainly gets you into the meat of the game faster. Because what we found is, let's say a game on average takes 90 minutes. The first 40 to 50 minutes generally is the game getting going. And then, like you say, then things start to happen. And then for the next 20 minutes, and then there's a real flurry. And that's where the games are won or lost. Like, logically, that's always going to happen, right? The game is won or lost at the end. But you know what? You get what I mean. Like, the biggest change in VP totals happens towards the end of the game. You don't have, like, a massive spike of VPs and then it slows down. It generally accelerates through as the game gets stretched. So all it does is, this is one of the exciting things about it, is it helps to accelerate through that first phase. And gets you closer to that second phase. Now, depending on your play style, and depending on so you could be ultra defensive and put your big blocky kind of tanky guys up front, and then still sit back and try and protect the ball and turtle up and slow play it. But at least your opponent's got a couple of models to interact with, rather than what the current state is you can just do that on your 10-inch deployment line and not really move forward with the ball. And basically turn up that way. So
yeah, so that's obviously very early on in, you know, development. You want to throw that out to the community, but has it made you think about threat ranges? Because, you know, we all look at like a 20-inch threat range. If you can, you know, manufacture that first turn kind of goal, is fantastic. Does it, you know, having a model on the halfway line really changes a whole bunch of models' abilities? Have you looked at that and whether you'd have to alter those, like threat ranges of certain models?
That's one of the things that's on the list of things that we're hoping to get a lot more insight from, having, you know, the community playing the game.
Yep.
And trying this out, because, you know, it's definitely something that we're aware of. You know, turn one goals from your own deployment line, I don't know how cool they are, if I'm honest with you. So there's something that I'm aware of. And certainly that's going to be exaggerated or exacerbated by the fact that you've actually got models now another, what would it be, another 8 inches forward. Turn one goals are going to be a lot more feasible. But then what I'm hoping and what we have seen in games where we play football teams against football teams is you end up with that almost basketball kind of feel where someone scores a goal, but then because the play is already stretched, you can get a reciprocal goal relatively quickly thereafter and you end up with the game going backwards and forwards. Now, if you're a super tournament player, highly efficient, I'm sure there's an awful lot of arguments for you not doing that. But we're not all like that, right?
Yeah.
Most of us want to have an amazing game of football with lots of goals and action going on. And that's kind of what we're aiming for. But, you know, the efficiency side of things and the high-level competitive play side of things is something that will also, you know, come out. And this is why a change such as this is important for us to get a bit more of a wider perspective on it before we, you know, commit to it effectively in one format or another.
No, I like it. I really like it. So I guess, you know, moving on from that, I one of the other things I wanted to talk about in terms of, you know, development, what you guys have learned ongoing. I think we had a quote, or one of the podcasts had a quote talking about, season two, you added one new guild to the mix. Season mm-hmm. three, you've added two.
Yeah.
Have you guys revised that or thought about that ongoing? That, I mean, it's, you know, it's potentially exponential, so you're not going to add, you know, a whole bunch like seven to season eight or whatever it is. But have you learnt a lot from putting more guilds into the mix and how you need to playtest and develop them and what you want to release each season?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked. I mean, we've certainly learned a lot, and one of the things that's really important to us is for us to try and make sure that the new releases, when they come out, aren't perceived as being the instantly the strongest in the meta. And, you know, like, I'm not interested in trying to create and sustain a power creep. But conversely, I don't really want new releases to come out and be like, we're so scared of making them strong that we end up making them weak. And that creates its own problems as well when we do stuff, you know, if we were to do stuff like that. So, it's a bit of a tricky balancing act. But what we have learned through developing, the farmers and the blacksmiths is a refinement of our development process, which allows us to come up with ideas for teams that are compelling ideas and develop them very, very rapidly, which, you know, as we get better and better at doing this, means that we can be releasing, you know, more teams should we feel that's the right thing to do for the game. And that goes back to one of the things we talked about Guild Ball consistently from the beginning, was the is the concept of breadth versus depth. And what we're mindful of is if we go too deep into each guild's roster, at some point in time, one of two things eventually happens. One is you run out of ideas and you start overlapping with existing models within your guild. You run out of ideas? You run out of design space
for what
that guild is supposed to be all about. And you either overlap with existing models, and at that point you end up with, you know, well, model A is exactly the same as model B, but model B is like slightly better at this, so, you know, never play A and always play B. You know, we could almost call that like the mechanothrow argument, right? To give a relevant, you know, example for people that they might latch onto is like everything in when I was playing War Machine and playing Grix was, well, yeah, I see it's a new unit you've come out, but it's not as cheap or as efficient as the mechanothrolls, so I'm going to stick with my, you know, mechanothrolls. So,
absolutely.
You get the idea. So if you're trying to avoid doing that, what you then end up doing inadvertently is you end up straying into the domain of other guilds. So, you know, you end up creating a model that arguably should probably be in the fish team instead of in the butcher's team, because it's, you know, much more goal scorey and a lot more fragile because you're trying to create differential within the butcher's team. So What it means is that there's a finite number of pieces that we can put into each team. Now, whether we're at that point or approaching that point or beyond that point is still up for discussion, and certainly we talk about it and think about it quite a lot. Personally, I still think there's some headroom on the existing guilds, and it's headroom that I want to explore. We've had a couple of very cool ideas about 6-9 months ago for how we can explore that headroom in a way that opens up a lot more options for us as a development team in the future should these ideas really take hold. And I think that's probably something that we can chat about in a probably about a month or two's time when we start talking about that side of things. So I'll be a little bit mysterious about that with your forgiveness, but I promise I'll come back and chat about those when the time is right. But yeah, I mean, so right now we're getting better all the time at developing models. We're getting better all the time at developing teams and playtesting them and balancing them. And what that means is our output capacity is greater, and that gives us lots of opportunities with where we can take this game and how we can develop new content for it. And it's hard because, like, in a deeply philosophical way, every model you release is kind of in a way hastening the demise of the game. You know, if you don't constantly course correct as you go through and be aware of the impact of each new release and how that is effectively going to affect the overall life cycle of the game. And, you know, we all love Guild Ball so much that obviously you never want it to die. It's a bit like your mum or your dog, you know, but
you've not
deep down
mom,
know that there is a life cycle. Oh, yeah. But you know there is a life cycle, but what we're trying to do is make it as rich and as varied as possible. So it's super fun. You know, we want it to be a fun ride as long as it lasts, and we want to make it last as long as we possibly can.
Nice. So what you're saying is the Seamstress's Guild is coming out season 4. That's basically what you said then.
When I'm really like desperate for cash and looking to line my retirement fund, I'm gonna hit up with the Hookers and Whores Seamstress Guild, and we're gonna make real money.
You've got Seamstress's Guild. You throw in a quilt maker who's got pinned and snared. Like, it all just makes complete sense. Like, it's already there for you.
I do like that you've managed to avoid these traditional kind of fantasy tropes about female characters. That's one of the most attractive things about Guild Ball for me.
Try and, like, here's the thing, right? It's a relatively recent conversation. I and the development team, when we talk about these things, we don't go out of our way and say, do you know what, we absolutely need an Indian character, or we absolutely need a chunky guy style model, or a skinny ugly girl. What we do is we come up with cool characters that we think are interesting and have a story to tell, and they almost naturally create themselves visually. So I think what we've got is quite a body shape, size, indiscriminatory approach. We almost don't think or care about it. We like, what's more interesting is who the characters are. So I think it's more a reflection on our outlook on life, really, that's being manifested through the models that we're making. That, you know, yeah, as you say, we have a relatively positive profile in terms of, like, body imaging. We do have big guys, we have big girls, we have, you know, skinny guys, skinny girls, we have some hot, some not, you know. They're all just kind of Guild Ball players with their own personality and stories to tell, and I think that's the important thing about it.
And some that are attractive to animals.
Ten, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 1. Intermission. Now it's time for satisfaction. Tasty. Refreshing. Exciting. Sophisticated. burgers. Remember, once you're finished, flush, then clean the cinema toilet thoroughly. You'll need to get it right in there. Go on. Round the rim. And under the bowl. And don't forget to wipe underneath the seat. Brushes and gloves are available from the cinema foyer for a £10 deposit. Leave it clean.
Patrons are reminded that if you see the smoking ghost, please report it to the nearest usher or usherette, who will summon the manager of this cinema to perform an immediate exorcism. Enjoy the film.
You meet on the moors, a man someone down the pub told you about. You say the code word, give him the special hand signal, three rubs, and the deal is done. You're buying a used condom. After all, it was cheaper, and the man did say he'd washed it. But how do you know? Just think of where it's been. Even if you know the man, never buy a used condom.
Seven, six, five, four, three, one. Intermission of ear.
Slug fuck.
Nights. There you go.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
I had an okay day. It's better now.
Oh, I fucking love Thursdays. So we've got a slug fuck lined up. Fantastic.
We do. And not only do we have a slug fuck, we've got a twist on the slug fuck.
We have indeed. So is this twist, I'm just, you know, throwing it out there, to do with the deployment testing going on at the moment?
It is.
Cool.
Partly because I'm intrigued by the whole prospect.
Yeah.
And partly because I'd like to get slug fuck over as quickly as possible.
Yeah, let's start basically turn two. Fantastic.
Indeed.
Yeah,
that'll nice. Cut like 30 minutes off the game.
Yeah.
Limited time.
We should actually have a, a record of how quick we've accomplished a slug fuck. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, how quick we can get the slugs to fuck, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And then, I guess what, we release an episode at the end of the year called Slug Fuck Viagra.
How to get your slugs fucking faster.
I don't...
Or for longer.
So confused.
No. Fantastic. So what's the matchup?
Well, we're going to take Young Mountain's suggestion from over on Singled Out, pairing Honor against...
Pin Vice. We're going to do the matchup of the, what's it called? The extra activation straight away.
Linked activations.
Linked... You know, it occurred to me today there is one other guild that has the linked activation, but at the moment I don't think it's viable throwing them in because only two models kind of get it and they're not fantastic together.
Right. You're talking Hunters.
I'm talking Zerola for hard. So anyway.
So I guess I will be playing Honor this evening.
You can play Honor, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, unless you want me to play Pin Vice, I don't care.
We can just rock, paper, scissors for it. Like, it's going to be good either way.
Yep.
I've never played Honor before, so, you know.
So you kind of want to give her a bash, do you?
Yeah, either or, because I've packed Hammer. I'm all in fucking Hammer. I just want to see. I don't know, you know when you get that yearning to just beat someone's face in with a big fucking mallet? That's essentially what I want to do.
I feel that way on a daily basis.
Well, yeah, usually when I'm, you know, talking to clients over the phone, that's how I kind of feel, and that's where I'm at the moment.
Just picture brutal violence.
Yeah, great. Yeah, basically. So I want to get some Hammer on. So I am in a bit of the Mason's kind of mindset, but I'm happy either way.
Nah, come on, Cam. I think you've stated your position clearly.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So yeah, that's good. I've played into Masons a fair bit. I've had the pleasure of playing against Beaston on Vassal quite a bit. So he's instructed me in the ways of Masons.
Nice.
So maybe I can help you out.
Yeah. Like triple countercharge. Oh wait, that doesn't exist.
Not yet.
Nah. One day.
A girl can dream.
Yeah. The monkey will have a flea, and the flea can get a triple countercharge. I don't know. Fantastic. Yeah, so I've basically been tossing around a pretty straightforward lineup. There's, you know, four models that pretty much are auto picks.
Yep.
When we're talking about, so the Honor Harmony linked, obviously, otherwise it wouldn't work. And then the Tower and Marbles match up. Probably, sorry, not Tower, Brick and Marbles, and then throw Tower in for the Tooled Up. So basically leaving one slot, which is probably going to be little shooterini Flint.
Flint himself. He does get it done.
Yeah, you know, when someone wants to score goals, he goes down like a sack of shit, but he scores goals pretty fucking well.
He does.
Yeah, and the 4-2 trade is pretty good with him, so...
Yeah, superior strategy.
Ugh.
He is. So what'll I play? I'll play Pinvice, I'll play Mother, because, you know, there's only one correct choice. I think I'll play some Hoist, some Ratchet, and then it gets a bit loose, doesn't it? I might actually turn towards Velocity. And
Wise. It's never a bad choice.
Then Velocity. It's a question of, like, probably Colossus, or maybe Harry. Yeah.
It's interesting. I've been chatting to Singled Out Andrew, and we talk about what that final slot is. He's playing a lot of engineers at the moment, and it's really, it's matchup dependent. So, you know, it's a Colossus, Locus, Harry kind of slot, we feel. And it's just, it depends on who you're going into and what you feel like you basically need in that slot. So
I do feel that Harry presents some interesting possibilities given my preferred playstyle, which is a bit towards the beady side of things.
I think knocking down and, you know, funneling people into the death ball is it's pretty good.
Yes. Maybe I can try and make him Mechanica and then get a linked play off him.
Nice.
Maybe that'll be the goal. I don't know. So probably worth talking about the new deployment rules.
Yeah, actually, I think this is quite interesting coupled with the linked play. So the deployment rules, if you haven't seen them, got chucked up on a forum post recently, end of last week, and basically stating, it's a bit of a test for good old Steamforge and seeing what people like, to try to get the game into that stage of, you know, punching people in the face and not that keep you off game style.
Yeah, contracting first turn, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And so essentially you need to have two players touching the center line, your deployment line, and then essentially your goal line. And it's alternate picks to do this. You can't put a player within 3 inches of an opponent, though, in this, because obviously with four players being deployed along the center line, you know, you can't start off engaging unless you're Mallet or Thresher. And yeah, I think it'll be interesting, especially with the links, because all of a sudden it'll open up those really quick linked get into someone's face kind of plays. So I can see Pinvice you know, linking into Hoist, and then Hoist just wrecking face after he's been overclocked and tooled up. And on the flip side, I can also see the Honor Harmony link play working quite well. So I mean, I'm actually going to try to trigger that off the start of the game and just see what happens there.
Let's break the game as fast as we can.
Yeah, testing's over. It's shit. Doesn't work.
Yeah.
No, I really like this idea. We chatted to Matt last week, and that'll be part of this podcast. And we talked about that dynamic and how it speeds up the game. And I like anything that, I don't know, you know, he talked about gaming time being, you know, we're all gamers, but we all also have a finite amount of time. And I really like the idea that the game actually can be faster. You know, we've played games that you score all the points at the end, and that's naturally because you posture for position early. Well, this kind of just speeds up that process. So.
Yeah, I know. Phil Bowen is—he's sad, man.
Oh, again.
He's sad. So maybe this is an opportunity to provide some feedback based on, you know, practice and.
Well, it is important to, you know, have some testing involved before you, you know, form an opinion on something.
What?
Yes. I believe so, anyway. That's just mine.
Well, I mean, that just runs counter to everything I've ever seen on the forums.
Rage first. Rage
Man,
out first.
I'm a big fan of Kantian a priori reasoning. I feel it's appropriate here.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, no, I think it's going to be a pretty cool setup. Barring any testing, I don't think we can really say much more other than we like the idea and, you know, who knows what form it'll take further on in Guild Ball, but you can see that they are actively trying to keep the game fresh, which I love.
Yes, as do I. And, I actually like that they just throw it out to the community and say, hey, here's an idea that we're toying with. You know, they recognize that whilst they do have, like, a dedicated group of playtesters, there's only so many games those guys can get in. And, you know, you throw that out to a wide network and actually you can just brute force it.
Yeah.
Work out whether it's a good idea or a bad idea.
I like that they've done it not with just new models like other certain gaming companies do, that they just use their customers as, you know, the field test and then dial them back. I like that they've just done it with a play style. Slightly different. A little bit more respectful, I feel.
Yeah.
So.
No, yeah. I'm all for a quick game, man. I love the fast ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if I can get like an hour-long game in, then, you know, that's great.
Oh, it's definitely a two-game night for sure.
Yeah.
Nice. Hey, did you see, or have you been getting in on the creative writing area?
I actually have.
Yeah.
I posted my story. Smashed it out. Got it up there.
I wrote one. I'm just not sure it should be out there in the public eye.
Is it erotic?
It does refer to certain parts of the female anatomy, yes.
Wow.
Well, you know, I had to get onto the Seamstresses Guild. You know, the red rag was basically shown to me by Steve Forge, so I had to dial it up and talk about a rookie from said guild. So I actually think I've come up with a really cool dynamic for which the guild can actually play too. So, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's all free for them too. You know.
Yeah, look, it's...
You know, barring the farmer's box they're going to give me, but, you know.
You're that confident?
Oh, absolutely. Well, given that I'm contemplating whether I even put it up. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, don't let your dreams be dreams, man.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I got mine up. I went with the Hunter's Guild because...
Yes.
Yeah.
I've read yours. I love it. I love everything about it.
Thank you. Thank you. Very kind.
If you haven't seen any of these, jump on. Is it? It's one forum thread, or you have to basically start your own.
Yeah. Right? If you go to the homepage for the forums, and you go down to Tales of Infamy, it's within that section of the forums. It's like a little bit tricky to find, but if you're persistent, you'll get there.
Nice.
And then, it's posted under the Scholars Guild Summer Challenge.
Nice.
There's some good stuff up there as well. Like, there's some, you know, there's some very creative people in the Guild War community.
Yeah, I saw an Astronomers Guild one.
Yeah, that was cool, that one.
That was interesting. Yeah. I like that. And I like the challenge. I mean, for me, the challenge, I mean, my writing isn't fantastic. But the challenge of trying to thread in a bit of a new guild dynamic, that's the way I kind of took it.
Yeah.
So I messed around with that. And unlike in my high school years, I'm actually struggling to keep it under 1,000 words as opposed to, you know, just reaching that 1,000 words. Yeah.
You got a lot of words trapped in there.
No, absolutely.
Just waiting to come out.
They're incoherent. They don't go together, but right. Yeah, they're trapped in there.
Like autism. What's that?
Basically.
So I kind of took the opportunity when I was writing to, like, hopefully, like, write a character that they would want to make.
Nice.
And so for the Hunters, I looked at shit that would actively assist the guild and cover some of its apparent deficiencies.
See, I love that. And I wonder if, like, reading the Astronomers one as well, like, you know, some of the ideas behind the guild come into, and you can see that the person's actually thought about the dynamic and the playstyle on the board. Yeah, I love that. That's really cool.
Yeah, there's going to be some competition.
I just like that Cena comes out in yours. Fucking bear.
Oh,
yes.
I love that bear.
Yeah.
Man, my love for Hunters is,
So do you think, you know, they'll get a new release? I know they probably, we've only got one release, or they've had their, you know, lot for this season. So, you know, next year, hopefully, something.
I'm sure they will, man. Mm. I'm sure they will. Like, of all the guilds, well, they're up to 6-10 players now. So, when you look at the Union bench,
yeah,
Like, there's an argument for them to be bumped up to those levels. Maybe not quite, but you know. What do most guilds have? Like 11 players? 12 players?
12? Is that right?
I don't know. I have to bloody whip out my phone and have a look.
Yeah, I think it is 11 or 12. Like, it's not. Yeah, you're right. So they're probably, you know,
they're
pretty
just
close.
About it.
Yeah,
just
absolutely. About. Absolutely. And for them, I guess it's more a case of filling the gap that, you know, people perceive as them needing, you know, whether it's a damage thing or a bit more control or something like that. I mean, people are still down on Theron. I think he's good, but trying to work out, you know.
They have 12. The Hunters have 12.
There you go.
I'm not counting Cena or Chaska.
You're
on. Some hate mail.
Yeah.
You fucking dickheads.
Can't even get it right. Can't
yeah,
even fucking
you
count.
You Australians are shit.
Dumb bastards.
You're in the future, but you're dumb as fuck.
Yeah, but the beauty of being in the future and dumb is we can correct our like decisions before
yeah.
anyone even
knows. We've got editing time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've got no fucking idea.
So, Honor v. Pinvice.
Hmm. That'll be cool.
Any you want to put bets on?
Bets? Well, given neither of us have played either that much, I think it will be quick. I'm going to call it's going to be a 2-2 win.
Yep.
I'm not sure, because I think the extra deployment will help Pinvice get, you know, a wicked legendary off.
Mm-hmm.
I reckon Honor's going to kick the fuck out of someone with Harmony. And I just... Part of that is going to be me just trying to spend 10 influence straight up every turn.
I do feel like her linked play is like way more efficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you don't give up the 3 influence, essentially.
Yeah.
So it's not like Pinvice just can spend 6 and then someone else spends 4.
Yep.
You really only spend 7 total. I find Pinvice's link is better for if you've set it up early for her to go in, punch someone and kill them. Like you set it up the turn before, and then you link and get a goal as well. Like that's the way you get the 6 point there.
Yep.
The Honor Harmony is quite different. So.
Yeah, I think.
I'm hoping I can wreck face, basically. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, I mean, it is written on your t-shirt, so.
Yeah, yeah. Wreck Dave's face.
Man, the ravages of time have done that. And my poor choices as a younger person.
We've all been there.
It makes fools of us all, Campbell.
No. I lived in London for 2 years. I don't need to say much more.
All right. Mm. I thought it was just a septum piercing.
Mm. No, I've had all sorts of fleshy parts pierced.
Fantastic.
Mm.
All right. Maybe we'll see these guys on the flip side.
On the other side, when we get a glorious recap.
Back.
Slugfuck.
Jesus Christ.
What?
Man.
We're not having a good run with the slugfucks, are we?
Oh, I think... My testicles are crushed.
So, you weren't too happy with that light setup?
I mean, like, getting 12-0'd is always fun. Missing one of those critical passes on your legendary is always fun.
Yeah, that
is pass.
That is a crutch of the Pinvice legendary, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that would have maybe kept me in the game a bit longer as well.
Yeah, I think it was pretty critical. You scored that goal, so basically, awesome game, but really quick. Obviously, awesome from my point of view.
Like 25 minutes.
It was so quick because of the way the deployment works. I'm already a fan of this because even afterwards, we'd started discussing strategies around what you can do with it, and it was really cool. We basically set up kind of skewing to each of our own right-hand sides a bit with the front deployment.
Yep.
But it just, it forced that early engagement, really threatened the ball. There were some interesting interactions with, you know, having my kit trying to kick in front of the models that I've got on the halfway line, which I think is pretty cool.
So you kicked off with Honor.
Yeah, so I moved up. I wanted Honor in the scrum, but I figured she can move up. Whoever kicks can just move up and kick and then get near Harmony and Flint. So I had them kind of as the threat.
The front line.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then had Brick... Brick back, Marbles was on the standard deployment, and Tower was on standard. Tower was on the back deployment as well. And Tower, I knew I'd just move up, tool up, you know, do that to Honor and kind of go from there. So
Yeah, I had pin vise and hoist on the front line, on the midline. I had ratchet and Harry on the sort of the normal deployment line, and then mother and velocity on the goal line. And yeah, having velocity that far back was an error. I think if I had put her on the midline with pin vise, there may have been the opportunity for like a way better, more aggressive play.
Yeah.
You know, and a link play, which we didn't get off that game.
We didn't. Well, technically we could have. Like I would have triggered on that last kind of turn for a kill, maybe. I think part of that was us learning. Like I've never played Honor before. I've played Masons plenty before, but I haven't played the Honor Harmony, and me getting the distances, like not having them starting within eight,
yeah,
suboptimal. And then same kind of goes with you. Like there were a couple of opportunities you probably could have done the controller,
yep,
but it's the big burn of the influence and, you know, obviously not having played as much.
I think I did make like a huge mistake with pin vise in that I spent one too many influence
punching
on. As opposed to just like maybe generating a bit of momentum, passing the ball to hoist, and then, you know, if the goal's not on the table and that pass does get missed, I can then shift my focus, put the, what is it, controller
onto hoist,
and then he goes and he's in goal range at that point.
Yeah, and you're legendary at that point, so he can always just pass, get a couple of dodge passes off with Harry in the middle and get up the pitch, no worries.
So what do we learn about the new deployment rules?
Oh, there's some pretty cool tactics. I think the deployment is actually critical. I mean, we talk about first turn in standard rules, but control of space on that center line is critical.
Yeah.
So I think when I put my kicking model down, you could have controlled the middle of the board with someone, like a velocity or even a hoist. So I think that's pretty important. It increases the threat ranges of a bunch of models.
Yeah.
Which I found, well, it doesn't increase their threat range, but it puts a lot more things in threat.
Yeah, anything with the ability to, like, kick a decent goal is going to score from the midline.
Yeah, and having Flint on the midline, like, I just didn't have to put that much on him. He got a tap-in goal going into Mother. Mother grabbed it off a deviation after I knocked down Ratchet. But, yeah, he'd been punched up. He just cleared conditions, where'd they go, walked up, stole the ball, has a shot. Yeah. So
I think as an example of better deployment strategy from that game, if I had put pin vise on the normal deployment line and velocity on the midline, I could then have retrieved the ball with pin vise, passed it to velocity to generate some momentum, and then used controller on her for her to go and score an immediate goal.
Absolutely.
And I'm two activations down, yeah, that's fine, but I'm also 4 points up.
Well, and potentially, you don't have to burn that much, you know, that's...
Yeah, that's right.
Four influence on pin vise and maybe only a couple on velocity.
Depends on velocity.
And it's something you can pre-measure all of that because it's after the kickoff, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, yeah, we did talk about that, or even, like, engineer specific, but having velocity and hoist as your two front line. You know, hoist is that tank, but he also threats quite well. You can throw an alternator in there with pin vise, and then either of them score from most places. So
I think maybe even having like a mascot on the front line like Mother, with the ability to throw out a burrow for hoist.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, that could be interesting as well. But you're dead right, man. Like, deployment strategy is a real thing. And neither of us gave it much thought.
Which is kind of... Well, you gave me a... who I was going to kick with. I went to kick with Flint, and then all of a sudden I went, that's just fucking stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, but... you're completely correct. Like, we didn't really think about it. We end up kind of skewed to our right, which was interesting. The battle line was kind of this diagonal across the pitch, which meant that, yeah, we came into each other in a similar kind of way, but each of the goals, well, each of us had a couple of models closer to the enemy goal, which was pretty cool.
I think in terms of it contracting the first turn, it totally did.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel like we weren't playing a normal game in a way, you know what I mean?
No.
Like, it just felt that all right, there was stuff, and it was all immediately doing something.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool.
Probably one good takeaway I would say is also, I've heard other podcasts talk about this, and I've even thought about this, to try to set up situations to practice. I would say if you're looking to practice models and mid-game interactions, then set up like this, because it gets you into that, you know,
that's
mode
a good point.
So much faster. You're already there. You've got models that you can threat on. It would change some static models' distances quite a lot. Like, imagine a hammer in the middle of the pitch.
Yeah.
Like, okay, yeah, you knock him down or you push him back a bit, but all of a sudden he's not taking that turn to threat, you know, people, and with marked target or something like that, he threats a long fucking way.
Well, that's true, yeah. It changes the values of captains, I suppose.
So, yeah, nice. Another thing I did notice was also the distance between the standard deployment and the halfway line.
Yep.
When I was moving stuff, I felt like those two models on the halfway line were a little bit isolated, which was interesting.
Yep, yep.
So I think I'd definitely think about that in terms of deployment and where on the pitch I sat them, whether I sit them, you know, a little bit wider, just to protect them a little bit.
Yep. I'd really like the whole positional play. You know, it means that, at least looking at it from the engineer's perspective, you can have, like, your ratchets sit at the back of the field where they probably want to be anyway.
Mm.
You know, and in terms of team composition, it makes more sense to have them laid out as they would be in a game like soccer, or a game even like, you know, AFL or something like that. You know, everybody's playing to their...
at their position.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sort of bore out. Like, it felt pretty good like that.
I did notice, and it was maybe part of both of our teams, that they have certain passive players, or slightly passive. So, you know, Tower and Ratchet are a good example, and also I had Brick, where they don't tend to put much influence on them. I think that becomes a little bit more important too in those early turns, that, you know, you're not going to deploy models on the centre line that aren't going to get work done, and you really need to think about what interactions they're going to kind of have.
Yep.
You know, and how that's going to bear out in the game. It still falls into that situation that I, or when I do team composition, that I think about, is I always like to have at least two passive kind of models that have, you know, abilities like your counter charges or a goalkeeper, that kind of thing. And it plays into that quite well.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm.
Yeah. I think I'm really keen to give it another shot.
Yeah.
I love the speed of it.
Maybe we do it with our full-blown teams. You know, we do a Blackheart Midas kind of setup.
Yeah, the stuff that we've actually practiced
with. Yeah, or, you know, just any kind of captains we practice a bit more.
Yeah. Keen to see Fillet and how she goes in that scenario.
Yeah.
She's going to have a fun time.
Well, exactly, if you're not. Yeah, you're receiving. She doesn't necessarily choose to kick there. It also has an interesting effect on who the kick receive.
Yeah.
And the kicking team essentially gets one, you know, almost gets three models to the halfway line.
Yep.
So, yeah, no, it's pretty cool stuff there.
Do you see it as needing more work to adapt to tournament play? Do you think it's viable for tournament play?
I reckon it's definitely viable. I think it'd need more testing before, because, you know, we played one game of it and we saw some really cool interactions of the deployment and also what you can achieve. I think there'll be some broken stuff with having two models on the halfway line, that maybe, you know, something needs to happen there.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they go one model halfway, one, you know, three on your standard deployment, two on your back line. I don't know.
I don't see... Maybe in the case of something like Honor and Harmony, right, I can see you one rounding a model with one activation.
Mm.
And that's a bit of a worry. With no ability to counterplay.
No. Oh, well, other than deploying a fucking mile away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm probably not going to do it to, like, a tank.
No. You're going to spend 10 influence, though, right?
Yeah.
At effective tax 6 and then tax 7, because you'll have a crowd off the other one. Right?
Sure.
So, I did like that. I saw, I fell in love with the Honor Harmony Marbles setup. Like, tooled up Honor with Marbles is just fucking gross.
Yeah, she's...
It was so good. Like, Pin Vice doesn't usually go down that easy, but when I was able to kind of push her into Marbles and then just...
She does when you fucking go full magic dice. It's like 8 dice, 4 fives. Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. No worries.
I just kill you now.
Yeah. But the damage bonus from marbles is really useful.
It's really cool. So it's definitely got me fired up about Masons. I mean, I was all talk about Hammer. I'll still get stuck into him, but Honor, I think there's a bit more to be explored there. I definitely fucked up a few interactions, or not fucked up, but could have just done, you know, things better in certain ways. You know, I burnt a legendary just because I needed more influence because I misallocated.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I see what you've been saying about Pym Vice's legendary as well. Like, you've really got to set it up properly.
You got to, yeah, and know when you're going to do which pass and what you've got to protect if you miss that pass.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how do you recover?
Yeah, I like to always start off with her passing, not moving, and that way, if you do miss the pass, your number one fallback is her sprinting and getting it.
Yep.
And then thinking about being close to the friendly models when you pass and move past them, such that the deviation can still go onto their base and you can control her and just get them to score, things like that.
Tell you what, trying to punch on her at 3-2 makes me understand why people don't like Blackheart. 3-2 is a pretty good stat line, though.
Yeah,
it's not bad.
Yeah, I've always thought, like, aggregate of 5 between your defense and your armor, I think, is a good baseline. I think if you've got a combination thereof, anything below that, and it's just like, oh, you can get a bit squishy. Or...
Yeah, 3-1.
3-1, or, you know, so 4-1's pretty good, 5-0's pretty good.
Yep.
3-2's good.
Yep. Yeah, so I played Ellie after that.
Yes, yes.
Did some Corsair.
He's getting better with the Corsair. A few interactions that I reckon... Well, we chatted about it afterwards, and he's only probably 5 games in. But you got back on the Blackheart horse after the...
Yeah.
Not liking Pym Vice.
Well, you know, I've played her all of 2 times. I like her. Just not very practiced with her.
So how'd the early game go?
Yeah, it was good. Just... Blackheart did Blackheart things. Actually, Greed was a fucking boss that game. He scored me a goal, got me a takeout, just like derped around the backfield, took out Corsair. That was always magic. It's like every time you take out Corsair, it's just
he's the heart of the side. I learned that the other day when we played it. Like, if you can get him, then it really makes it pretty hard for them to control and knock you down and kill you.
Yeah.
I mean, Siren can still get a fair bit of work done. She's still Vet Siren, she's still pretty OP.
She's gross, man.
Oh, with a couple of crowds. I think at one point Ellie punched Harry, your Harry, and he like double wrapped. Like, it was fucking gross.
Yeah, he was pink mist at that point. It's just like, he's done. Yeah, so nice. I don't know. Maybe we give the advanced deployment rules just a bit more of a go.
Oh, definitely. I thought
it was a lot of fun. Like, it was fun.
Fun, fast. It actually reminded me a little bit, and maybe it was the, you know, that newness to it, of the first time we played, where it was just like, fuck, I want to do that again.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyone who's down on it or hasn't played it, do it. It's quick. You can smash out a couple of games. Yeah. And fun.
Yes. It reminded me of kind of... I don't know, like, normal game of Guild Ball, that first turn always felt a bit like first turn War Machine, where you were basically trying to get, like, a hyper threat extension on something. So you try and pick out, like, a high priority model as your first priority in the first turn. And I do like that about Guild Ball, you know, setting up for one big activation as the goal of your first turn. But I also like the way these advanced deployment rules work, in the sense that actually the strategy gets a lot deeper, and you're like, in what order do I have to activate things to score a goal or get a takeout or prevent a takeout?
Well, yeah, and mitigate, you know, a whole bunch. That's the thing, because you have everything, not everything, but a lot of your stuff from the start is already engaged or in threat range, not engaged.
Yeah.
You know, and so you've got to look at, okay, I can get the ball there, but he's got 3 models, not just that one, or I can't just be, you know, scaredy cat and sit off.
Yeah, it's immediate response.
Mm.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
I think it brings in a lot of the passive abilities too. You know, your close controls, your...
poised.
Yeah, any of those, I think, probably adds value to them. Because you've got models sitting there waiting for something to happen to them, so...
Yeah. All right, man. We'll have to.
I like it. Let's do that again.
Another 25-minute game seems good.
Yeah.
Woo.
Nice one.
Slap for.
Slap.
That's nice. Welcome back, Matt. We fucked up. This recording is a testament to our technological inability. You're very kind to give us your time again. We deeply appreciate it. I know you're a busy man. So, picking up where we left off, I think the last thing that you said was some models were into animals, which I feel is a good point to jump back into the conversation. But if we're going to move things along, I think the last time we spoke to you, we were talking about the new deployment rules, the new formation rules for Guild Ball that we're all playtesting. Right. And there's been a bit of feedback since then. How's that looking?
Well, it's great to be back, and it's actually quite lucky to for us to have had a kind of week between the last time we spoke, because I do think we can like look at some of the feedback that's come from the formation stuff, and overall it's been really positive. A lot of the impact on the game that we thought that this change to the deployment rules might have, that we wanted to put the feelers out for, really has kind of delivered. You know, the games feel a lot more connected from the off. There's a really interesting side benefit, which is we're actually hearing an awful lot about players who previously were considered fringe are actually now seeing a bit more table time. So people like Granite, for example, you know, the fact that she can start on the halfway line makes her immediately a problem that you have to deal with for, you know, for your opponent. So it's great hearing about that. It's great hearing about things like, you know, Theron being stronger in this particular deployment format. So it really is kind of food for thought, and it's interesting because I don't necessarily want to think about this as a wider playtest insofar as there's a kind of like a numerical kind of function operating in the background for us to like, you know, categorize and assess precisely how well it's doing, but it's more of like an open beta, and it allows us to kind of to extend the video game analogy, it allows us to kind of test our servers and understand what the load might look like, and you know there's a thing that's come through that actually we hadn't anticipated, which is something we need to seriously consider, and that's, you know, it makes the game more difficult for newer players. It can be a lot more difficult for a newer player under the, you know, the new style deployment rules. So that's new information that I think maybe we would have got to it, maybe we wouldn't have, but the fact is we did through you know, getting this out into the community, listening to what people are saying, and it gives us an opportunity to, you know, to think about it. But I've been amazed at how positive people have been. You know, initial reactions, there's always those kind of couple of dickheads who have to post instantly on Facebook and say, you know, first, this looks rubbish, and it's like, come on, you know, please don't post that stuff until you've at least tried it once. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. We can all familiar with how the internet works, Matt.
sadly, yes. Yeah, I mean that is the internet, I suppose. But what's encouraging, and fair play to people who do try it and then, you know, actually post their results and talk about it. I know Jamie's been interacting with a load of people and trying a couple of different tweaks here and there, and I think he's planning on like a full update, you know, based on what we've learned through the process. Yeah, no, it's really good. Like right now, I'm not going to lie, we're seriously considering this for season 4, which is November next year. So, you know, it's a long way off, but we're seriously looking at this because the love for it and the benefits for it have been massive. So, you know, it's obviously not perfect, not yet, but we've, you know, this is why, you know, we've got plenty of time to kind of to work on it and get it right. So yeah. No, I don't know, did you guys enjoy it?
Yeah, we rolled out a game, what was it, last Thursday. Yep. And One, it was so much faster, and two, neither of us actually grasped the depth of deployment in terms of the strategy within that as far as we should have, and we chatted about it afterwards. But it did add this extra layer of strategy to the game, which we both kind of loved in retrospect after we played the game.
Mm.
Yeah, so, I mean, even, like, you know, denial areas, like you said about granite sitting in the middle of the park, but, you know, certain models that can just basically have a threat or a denial in the middle, or even just putting one of your models right in the middle of the board as your first deployment, then denies 3 inches off them in either direction as well. So if you think they're going to counter-deploy on the center line, just ways of kind of pushing them away from terrain and things like that.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think that's kind of like an interesting design challenge that we have is every single time you add more tactical and strategic decision points, it widens the gap between novice players and experienced players. You know, it widens the gap between good players and weaker players. You know, it's so it is always a balancing act, because you don't want to end up with a game that's impenetrable for a new player to come into. But similarly, you don't want to, you know, leave a game in a overly simplistic state that eventually lacks challenge for players as they gain in experience and ability. So it is always a balance, but. I think the formation rules have exceeded all of my wildest hopes for it. It was just an idea that I'd had when I was at Adepticon. Was it late last year or earlier this year? I think it was earlier this year. Up in Chicago, and just watching the way, you know, the Americans play it, and certainly like the top table guys who are at that particular convention. So, you know, people like Dan and Jordan and people like that and Alex. And how conservative they are, and how easy it is for them to stand off. And then you watch kind of players who actually just want to come and have a game and kind of run themselves forward, trying to actually make the game start, you know, get the game going, and they get picked off. And it's, you know, it's basically where the idea came from. And it's brilliant so far.
No, I love it. Have you thought about, and Jamie modelled to this, having like a 1-3-2 formation or messing with the numbers and which line they sit on, just to kind of curb that that skill kind of barrier?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, certainly what we'll need to do is make sure that there is like a standard formation that we recommend for kind of, newer players. But yeah, messing about with the numbers of models at each of the deployment lines, possibly, you know, I mean, I'm a huge fan of using the halfway line, because it's already marked on everyone's boards and everyone's mat. But potentially, you know, dropping that deployment back a couple of inches maybe might soften the impact a little bit. Mm. So we've got quite a lot of levers for us to mess about with. The challenge is always knowing which one you've pulled and how it's affected everything. So the temptation is to pull lots of levers and try, you know, yeah, different numbers, moving the lines around, doing this, that, and the other, and then something happens. You're like, oh, I don't quite know what we actually did that made that change. So it's great. It's in a really, really great position. I'm really, really happy with it.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It does take a village to raise a child, no question. I have really loved the way it forces careful strategy on the part of the receiver and the kicker. And, you know, you can have a striker up on the midline, but you have to be very careful about how you feed that striker because of the alternating activation system. We're playing a game where we had linked players with teams with linked ability, so Honor Masons versus Pinvice Engineers. And that again opens up another possibility with a receiving play, which I thought was really interesting. You know, you receive the ball, but then you have to get the position right in terms of, you know, retrieving the ball. So maybe you know, you've got your striker on the midline, you retrieve it with a certain model that can trigger linked, and then you send that striker off to score the goal as your opening move. I find that really interesting, just in terms of making you think through both your order of activations and how to take sometimes abilities. In the case of Pinvice, you don't always want to use that link. But, you know, here's a good opportunity where you can take something that may be a little underutilized, and it actually becomes a viable opening strategy. It's, you know, a good opening gambit. And I think that probably ties into what you're saying about the depth of people thinking about how to use players in different positions. You know, a midfielder is suddenly a midfielder. A winger is a winger, and you're rewarded for playing in that way, which I think is something you've always been pushing towards anyway.
It's certainly something that we've looked for, and you know, when we first started marking the players with their, you know, their specialist positions and everything, and I think as we talked about last time, you know, we were chatting about, you know, abilities that are a bit more like locational on the actual board, so you know, like Vet Brisket and her proximity to the, you know, to the sidelines and goalkeepers, you know, being 4 inches away from the goal to get XYZ benefit. So it's definitely a direction that we've been pushing in. What I really like about it as well is very much the fact that you can start thinking about these things and almost formulating strategies before you get to the table. So if you know you're playing again, you know, you're let's say you're building a Masons team, right? And you know that against Fish you're going to go for this kind of formation, and yet against Butchers you're probably going to go for this kind of formation. So you might, you know, in Butchers you might stick Granite up front, you know, with Tower, Brick kind of hovering in midfield, and then a couple of fast guys at the back because you kind of want your tanky guys up front to sort of absorb the hit, soak everyone up, lock them up in a tar pit, and then let Flint and, you know, Harmony or whoever kind of maraud around, you know, around the wings. Whereas against Fish, you might want to put your fast players up front, your ball retrieval players, maybe Angel gets a look in, gets, you know, with a momentous tackle on the one, suddenly she becomes a danger if she's, you know, sitting right on the halfway line. I just think it gives you a lot more flex in terms of who you can bring from your roster and how you can use them, and, you know, gives you opportunities to think about how you can prep for certain, you know, certain matchups. So I think, you know, it just opens up a lot of possibilities for players, which I think is great.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's one thing I've noticed, and moving over, well, years ago now, but from War Machine, was the kind of dojo time you'd spend looking at lineups with War Machine, because you have those static kind of setup situations that you want to start and how you roll that out. And I noticed that the other day as I was looking at formations, and Dave and I even chatted about it with the Pinvice scenario afterwards, that you can have set plays that you want against certain teams. And I think that's really good. And almost, I think once a new player gets past that early curve of learning the game, actually can set up pretty standard starting formations to actually aid them in getting through the game or getting into the game in, you know, a beneficial kind of position.
I think what's interesting about it is, like, you know, you know my backstory. I've played a lot of War Machine and would spend quite a lot of time sort of theory machining and thinking about lists and everything. But what I found going on, like, the various faction forums was the kind of discussions that were going were very samey. They were very kind of efficiency or points, you know, value orientated, and people would put a list up, and you know, you wouldn't necessarily get what the point of that list was. And it felt like, do you guys get like fantasy football down under? Do you know what I mean? Like, so you basically, what you got is you got your 100 million and you're trying to buy your premiership team out of everyone, and you're trying to just juggle. Like, you're looking for a defender for 4.5 million because that's all you got left. You don't really care who it is. And that's what kind of list building felt a little bit like for me in War Machine. It was just, this is the most efficient list that I can make, you know, and it's not, here's the idea, here's the theme, here's how I want to play it. And yet when I play a game like Netrunner and you go on like Netrunner DB and you have a look at like the various lists that are there, what's important about them, not necessarily the cards that they put in there, but the actual blurb that they put on it talking about how this, you know, how this deck is intended to play, you know, it's much more polarized in terms of you have to have a much clearer strategy of what you're looking for. What are the combos that you're trying to pull? What the cards you're looking to tutor out of your deck at what times? And all that kind of stuff. And when I look at like the formations for Guild Ball, I see much more along the lines of that Netrunner style. So it's like, well, here's my lineup. It's like, well, I don't really like Granite. Well, guess what? I'm playing her left to center because I think, you know, her up front controlling that space, and I tuck Brick in behind because he's got a counter charge, you know, and then Towers over on the right, and that's my triangle of tar pit death. Right now, it's you've actually got a conversation going that actually completely disabuses the original, you know, that knee-jerk internet dickhead reaction of kind of saying, oh, well, that's rubbish. Granite's rubbish. Well, no, she's not, if she's in the right position at the right time. And now formations gives you the opportunity to kind of to create those kind of shapes on the on the playing field or the battlefield. So I think it opens up a lot more opportunity for great discussion as well. The fact that we're getting fringe players coming through is amazing. Yeah, no, it's brilliant. I'm really excited by it. I don't know if that kind of comes across or not, but I kind of can't wait.
Very excited.
I can't wait until my next game. I've got a couple of ideas I want to try out.
It does reflect actual sports a lot better as well. I mean, you look at American football, you look at Australian rules, look at rugby. You know, they're not starting at two ends of the field. Soccer, they're not starting at two ends of the field away from each other. And I think a lot of the strategies that and tactics that are borne out in those sports are formational. So, you know, if people have been complaining, oh, Guild Ball's moving away from being a sports game, actually the formation rules brings it back into line with a lot of the stuff that goes on in reality. That's quite interesting as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. And look, like, if you look at the history of football, when the Football League was first formed, the standard formation was two defenders, maybe one defender, a couple of midfielders, and then about six or seven people playing up front. Right, which is just bonkers now. When you look at that was it. That was the formation. That's brilliant.
This is pre-offside. Come on.
You know, this was pre-offside, absolutely. And, this was hundreds of years ago. But you know, you look at how football's evolved, and I don't know how closely you guys kind of follow sort of European football, but you know, everyone's heard of Barcelona and the tiki-taka football and how it's kind of, you know, influence teams over the last 10 years. And then suddenly some people like, you know, Jose Mourinho came along and kind of he understood how to dissect and destroy that style of play. And, you know, while he was at Real Madrid was famed for kind of, you know, basically crushing games and making them miserable. But he found an effective system that worked against them. So there's an evolution of the system. And I think that's what makes perfect such an addictive thing to watch over a long period of time, not just like 90 minutes on a Saturday. Is like being a football fan for, you know, I've been watching football for like 30 years, 35 years, you know, if not longer. And to see the evolution, to understand the progress that's being made, to sort of understand how the game is played and how one player's role affects how someone else can benefit, you know, elsewhere on the pitch. I think that's, I don't think there's ever going to be a thing which is a perfect formation. And I think that's wonderful, because it means that there's constantly opportunities to innovate and look for new ways of doing it and try old ways again. And, you know, that just keeps the game feeling fresh. You know, it's the same overpaid guys, you know, week in, week out. It's just different faces, different hairstyles. But it's more the tactics, it's more the strategy, it's more the, you know, how the game's actually played that I think is what keeps it really fresh for me.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. It's funny you said that about the formations, and so basically I've been coaching two of my son's soccer sides at the moment, right. And you start to get a real understanding of how the formation and not the ability or the talent has bearing on the outcome of the game. And you know, I overwatch this where, you know, so one of the sides we've got is an under eight side. So most of them are 7 year olds. And I'm just teaching them, you only have seven on the pitch, so one goalie, six, you know, running around, three attackers, three defenders. And we come up against a side that basically had a striker, two wingers, and then kind of these one centre back and two kind of defenders sitting behind the wingers. And I was fascinated by how they had taught that to these children and then got them to control certain spaces, and how aiding each other was such a bonus to the game. It's the same kind of thing. Like, yeah, situational and positional play makes so much difference over the skill of one singular player.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I coached under sevens, under eights and under nines as my kind of son was growing up, and then he kind of stopped enjoying it. So, you know, sadly, I kind of, you know, gave up coaching because I actually really enjoyed it. I mean, we used to drill an awful lot of times. And you've probably experienced this where you've got, like, the kid who's slightly better than everyone else and his dad now wants everyone to pass the damn ball to him all the time. Get it to, you know, whatever his name is, Dave. Get it to Dave. He'll score for you. It's like, actually, no one else is going to learn if all we do is pass the ball to Dave and Dave scores because he's, I don't know, been on steroids for the last year and about 2 foot taller than everyone else.
But, like, you're describing my childhood right now.
I've actually got a kid like this in my team too. That's hilarious.
So, I mean, what we did was... well, I actually did. So here's the secret to winning kind of under sevens, under eights, under nines football is train your kids how to head the ball, right? And then you basically have a wing, two wingers who can cross the ball and a kid in the middle who can head the ball. Like at that age group, no one can defend against it. It's just free money. Every time
half of them duck. I just go, what the fuck is that? It's going to hit me in the head and jump away. Yeah.
We used to do football training for 2 hours on a Saturday, and I used to spend at least half an hour every Saturday just doing headers, and that was it. Just crossing the ball and the guys in the middle heading it, and the defenders like learning how to try and defend against it. And we'd get to our games on a Sunday, and we'd just destroy teams, and like they would have no answer to it. Didn't matter what formation they were playing. Because if you duck when the ball's coming in, you ain't going to score.
Yeah, you're screwed.
It's hilarious.
No, I'm on it. I'm just taking notes on that. That's
yeah, do that. I'll send you some ideas after the show.
Yeah, brilliant. You quickly touched on what you like playing or getting back into it. What are you playing at the moment? I thought about it the other day.
Ah, right. So I'm prepping Masons for WTC.
Nice.
Which is fun. I'm kind of big Harmony fan, and especially the new Harmony. I love her to bits, obviously with Honor. But then I think Hammer is currently being... we're having a little look at Hammer, just because he doesn't seem... I think he looks great, but there's a couple of things that aren't quite right with him. I don't think his heroic gets used at all. It's certainly not enough, not nearly enough, which I think kind of puts him, for a lot of people, behind... Honor, but then again, it's all subjective. Like, you talk to people like Daniel Naus over in Germany.
That's what I was going to ask.
Naus, he crushes people with Hammer. He just turns up with Granite and Tower and Hammer and just destroys fools.
And like, Timmy was saying he gets flogged by him every time he plays him.
Yeah, yeah. So like, I think Naus, he's kind of like just gets it, but even he's sort of saying it'd be awesome if you know, if he actually had heroic that he might consider using. So, you know, we're having a little look at Hammer along with a lot of other models, just to kind of see whether we need to put an errata out or not.
Can you give us any info on whether you know if there is one on the cards, or that's TBD?
What, an errata?
Yeah, or any changes to any models.
So, I mean, an errata is always on the cards. Like, we constantly observe the game, and if we see anything that's outside of, you know, like the constraints that we allow ourselves, then we will act. But what we have to do is balance that with knowledge of stuff that's coming down the track that may have an impact. Like, going back to what we were chatting about earlier about Theron. So, you know, sort of 4 weeks ago, everyone's kind of, oh, Theron's really weak. Like, Theron's, you know, probably the weakest captain in the game, blah, blah, blah. Lots of kind of generally negative views on him. And yet the formation things come out. Theron's now able to start further out of the pitch. He can actually get his pinned out early on. He can, you know, he can use his, he can use his pin.
And then screw someone really badly. Yeah.
Right. And now suddenly he's actually had a spike in power, and we haven't had to touch the card at all. So, which for me, I think is a really elegant way of looking at, you know, A, how the game's played, but B, how it also impacts individual models. So, you know, whenever you're looking at an errata, you know, and certainly whenever you surf on the internet, there is lots and lots of opinions about how certain models can and should be fixed. But they're always based on an incomplete set of data. So, you know, we have a number of models that we're looking at more actively than other models at the moment. One of the things I'm looking for us to strive towards is parity of choice between captains within a team, I think is vital. I don't think it's healthy to have one captain obviously better than the other captain. You know, people like Naus notwithstanding, like generally, you know, you would argue that Honor was a better choice in most matchups than Hammer is.
It's a safer choice, if nothing else. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, maybe one closer to my heart is, you know, I think Philip brings a lot more to the table in more situations than Ox does. I think Ox is better than Philip at a narrower range of options. So if you were playing a game, you know, that your life depended on, I'd pick Philip, you know, rather than Ox. Whereas I'd love that to kind of be a closer to 50-50 choice, where if you're playing a game that your life depends on, well, you play the captain that you like the best and works the best for you, not not the one that is on paper more efficient or more or stronger. So we, you know, we're looking at a few bits and bobs. Obviously, we've got a bunch of stuff that I think SteamCon is when we're looking at to start sharing some ideas with people. Got a couple of new ways of actually configuring your team before you turn up to the table, which I think we might actually put out to like an open beta, again, largely because of the amount of possibilities that are combinations that are possible with it is quite a large number. So getting, you know, a wider data pool would be really useful to make sure that we haven't kind of missed anything obvious or slightly less than obvious. So the next sort of 2, 3, 4 months, there's going to be a kind of a steady rollout of ideas and actual stuff that should make you know keep the health of the game where it is, you know, or improve it. So
nice. So on the whole, and I think we covered this last time, but the internet gremlins got it. You're happy with how season 3 is kind of rolling out and the data you've kind of got back at this point?
So the fundamental personality flaw that I have is I'm very rarely completely happy. But
I can't help you with that.
No, if I look at it objectively, I think I've seen a lot of comments from a lot of different people that season 3 version of Guild Ball is the best version yet, and I thoroughly enjoy playing it. I do think it's one of the best balanced versions. I think the games are a lot more fun than certainly, sort of the obulous tractor beam phase of towards the end of season 2. So, but that being said, I don't think it's perfect, and I don't think it ever will be. You know, like we're talking about with real world soccer. Like, I don't think there is a perfection out there, but it doesn't stop us trying for it, and I think that's what keeps us hungry and keeps us working hard on stuff, is there is always that tantalizing dream that you might get it close to perfection. So, it's the further we go on, the hardest challenge is going to be not over tinkering with stuff. Like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Is an old Americanism, and it's definitely true. So we kind of ever more cautious about how changes can impact things as the game itself becomes more complicated. But it's good. I'm proud of season 3. I think I think the work that we've all done on that has led to it being a really decent game. We've seen a massive growth in new stores and new players coming into the hobby over the last couple of months, which is great. I mean, we're fully aware that the releases for existing players has been comparatively slower, but it kind of I won't say fits and starts, peaks and troughs, but everything's cyclical. So there'll be periods of intense new stuff that will make everyone super excited, and then just the way the world works, there'll be other periods where we won't have as much new stuff coming out. Because I think if we basically saturated bombs like our release schedule with like new stuff after new stuff after new stuff after new stuff, it would be, I think the game would die under its own weight. And we've seen other really high profile games that are really, really suffering from that right now. We see it in front of us every time we log on the internet and see this new model for this particular game. You're thinking, you just don't need that model, why are you bringing that one out? That's crazy.
It's an interesting segue, because we can go into some of the new stuff that you guys have out in terms of the blacksmith. So between the two recordings that we've done with you, we have had the release of one awesome looking model card for the model, and then a bit of fluff is Infernus. But I was listening to a competitive podcast. I think they're the 11th best podcast, Guild Ball podcast at the moment. And they posed an interesting question. I wanted to ask you this because I knew we were going to chat to you today. With the changes to the organized play document and the blacksmiths, was this thought about in terms of when you nominate your captain, your mascot? Because the blacksmiths won't have a mascot, will the captain and apprentice have to be nominated at that point in the lineup decision process?
Yeah, that is a really good question. Honestly, I don't know what the final answer is going to be for that. This is why my development team love me and hate me in equal measure, because I have crazy stupid ideas for guilds that don't fit into normal formats, i.e. there's no mascots, because I kind of like this master apprentice kind of idea, and that works better if there's three masters and three apprentices, so we don't need a mascot. But it completely screws over like things like the OP doc and stuff like that, and the core rules. So it's something we need to think about. That is definitely an option, which is when you declare the captain, you declare that captain's, or you declare that master's apprentice, you know, or we look to kind of remove the mascot step from the OP, you know, or we just rejig all the order in which you do things. So there's a lot of options there. So Ed and Jamie are both working on those at the moment. Fortunately, blacksmiths don't go on to kind of general release until later in the year, I think around SteamCon time, which is obviously when the new OP doc for 2018 will start coming out. So we have time to kind of really narrow down on the items we've got on the short list right now. But yeah, it's that's my fault.
It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. You quickly send him an email right now. Just say we need to fix this because there's something wrong here. Actually, it poses another interesting question, but you might not be able to or have the answer to this as well. Is obviously there's a benefit with the master apprentice scenario. I'm making the assumption that you don't have to necessarily take the master and their specific apprentice. Is
that correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Yep, no, correct.
Yeah,
and I can't remember. Let me just double check the card. Does it show back? Yeah. So, for example, on Furnace, if you look at Sentinel, it doesn't actually name a specific
apprentice.
A specific named apprentice. So you could stick all the apprentices next to Furnace and get them benefit from Sentinel, for example. So
no, absolutely. And so does was it Anvil? Is it? Who's also got the same Sentinel ability, so you can do the same.
Yeah, just quickly having a look at what's been put out there.
So Anvil and Sledge, and obviously the synergies therein.
Yeah, where?
It's all right. This is great radio. We can just basically edit this out and put some kind of elevator music in.
Do you know how much time I spend making people sound good? It's ridiculous.
That's fantastic. Okay, so I think I'll just click on Sledge. I'm just trying to remember which one. Oh, right, okay, we haven't released the full car for Sledge either. God, we are mean, aren't we?
There he is.
All right, yeah. So they are a good good example. So Sledge has the ability, which is tutelage, Anvil. So that will only work when he's with Anvil. But, Anvil has Sentinel, which will work with any apprentice. So there are combos. And I know Jamie kind of likes to mix up how many masters and how many apprentices he actually brings, because there's not actually a fixed limit on, you could take three apprentices. As the other blacksmith model come out, you could take four apprentices if you want and run two masters. That's entirely doable, I believe.
Nice. No, I like that.
In the vein of new stuff, I think when we spoke last, I asked you about Loxham's custom union models, the Sulthesian sculpts that he had done. And I think we had some conversation about how potentially these things may or may not become available in the future. Do you still hold to that position, Matt?
Certainly there's no further progress towards or away from that, so yeah, I still, nothing's changed, so yeah, I still kind of stand by that.
Did I hear Matt's dog in the background start barking then? I don't know.
Yeah, he's thinking again, bastard. No, it's something like this is the trouble of being a fan of the game that your company makes, and also having the ability to put your finger onto the big red button, because you can do, your imagination runs away with you. You have access to people like Russ, who is more than happy to kind of do some experimental ideas and come up with some cool looking new skins and stuff like that. And it kind of gives you a lot of pleasure as a gamer when you kind of have this kind of unique model. And then you think as a business owner, and you have a responsibility to the people who work for you, that you really ought to be finding a way of not wasting your time on stuff that doesn't actually generate any kind of revenue for the company, that you think, well, there must be a market out there. So how do we go about doing that in a way that, isn't exploitative? Like, we set Steamforged up to be a company run by gamers with the gamer's perspective in mind. The other side of that coin is we also have responsibility as business owners. So, I think finding a way of getting that out to people. I don't really want to do, you know, ultra limited edition. I don't want to do single show exclusives, like you can only buy this particular model at Gen Con, because that's where you end up seeing, you know, the secondary market going nuts and people kind of spending hundreds of pounds on single models and stuff like that. Okay. But you also want to inject a little bit of, you know, a little bit of, what's the word, rarity into it, a little bit kind of aspirational kind of qualities. I really want that, you know, Salthesian Union team. So, yes, it's just working out how we're going to kind of deploy that out to people. I know the guys are working on updating the shop front, like the Steamforge web store. I think that will probably be the easiest way for us to make these available. And I think a good starting point would be probably looking at something along the Forge World style business model, where, you know, we hold a small stock of these items, and if people want them, they can grab them. And if they, you know, if we run out, then we'll make another small batch of them, and, you know, and just kind of not necessarily, I don't really want to flood the market with them, but I certainly want to make them available to anyone who wants them. So, you know, yeah, I think a balanced approach to it is sensible. We're not, you know, we're not looking to kind of, I don't want to make a model that everyone feels that they have to come out and they have to buy, otherwise they're going to end up spending 200 quid, you know, on it in a couple of weeks' time for us to kind of cynically sell 1,000 models. I don't, that doesn't float my boat at all. Mm-hmm. But coming up with like a really cool idea for a visual look for a team, like a Winter Hunters, you know, skin would be kind of cool. I'd love to kind of sit down and work on that with Russ. It's easy for us to do. We can do it really quickly because we've obviously got the base models. If there's a demand for that, if people like the idea of that, we can do that. We can print some models up and see how it goes, you know.
There would be a demand for it. I'm opening my wallet to you right now, Matt. My money.
Exactly. I just heard something unzip then. I'm not sure what it was.
Yeah, that was my pants. Yeah.
But the other thing is that, you know, it gives us opportunities to do kind of sort of special case stuff. So like we have a guy in the UK who sadly is his mum passed away from cancer. So every year he does like a charity raffle, and we try and help him out as best we can to you know, so he can promote his charity. So it'd be great to have a mechanism where we could do like a, you know, like a cancer charity model where, you know, we just do it, put it up, and people who want it, who want to support that kind of charity, can do so, and it gives us a mechanism to do it. Because otherwise, how do we actually get it out to people? Mm. Like stores, it's not fair for us to ask distributors and stores to kind of stock these, you know, models that they may or may not sell. So that's the kind of thing that needs to kind of come from a central resource. Yeah. But similarly, we don't. Yeah, you know, it's another thing that we kind of, you know, we've got our mind on, but we want to try and do it the right way, because I think it's very easy to end up doing stuff the wrong way if you're not careful.
You do have a model that it is on the fringes a little bit, and people have been talking about, and might help charities that are along the amputee kind of vein of things. Can you explain where Lucky came from?
So Lucky was so Charles, our commercial director, had an idea, and I was chatting to him one night when we were at a show, and he said, do you know what would be amazing is if we, now that we're moving into PVC and obviously the unit cost is a little bit lower for us, do you think it's feasible for us to make a model that we give to people at shows when they have a demo? And I'm like, I don't see why not. That sounds like a cool idea. And he said, well, do you think it'd be possible for it to be a model that, you know, obviously Kickoff being Masons Brewers, could it be a model that could play for either side, and it would help people, you know, you play the demo, you get this cool model. If you then go on to pick up Kickoff, you've not just got six man, you've got a seven man team now, you know, and you can kind of swap backwards and forwards. And I'm like, yeah, we can absolutely do that. So he's like, oh, okay, cool, leave it with you. So I kind of then come up with this idea of a guy called Lucky, and he was called Lucky because he survived, he had a near death experience when a large bit of masonry fell from a bridge that they were constructing, and unfortunately it did rip one of his arms off. So he was either going to be called Lefty or Lucky, and I couldn't quite make my mind up. But now what he does is he spends a lot of his time kind of in the bars. He's like a poster boy, sort of chatting about the game. You know, he's a really popular guy, full of charisma, everyone loves him. He just happens to have just one arm because of a bad accident, really. But you know, all's well that ends well. So, yeah, anyway, so Charles is like, dude, you gave me a go with one arm. I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, no one's going to want that. And I'm like, of course they are. Why wouldn't they want that? It's a bloke called Lucky. He's got one arm. He's awesome. So that's how he kind of came about. So he's going to be like our promo kind of poster child model, poster boy model, to help kind of promote the game. A funny story was we did actually get an email from our factory in China, and they kind of said, we think there's a print error with this model. Can you reprint and send? And we're kind of like, what do you mean? Because like, well, obviously this arm here ends in this kind of stump, and we're like, no, that's on purpose. And the Chinese guys are like, what? And we're like, no, we did that on purpose. And they're like, what? And we're like, honestly. They're like, okay, it's your money. Like, I just think it makes it more interesting.
No, I like it. I like it. It speaks volumes of your personality there, Matt.
I surprise myself sometimes insofar as I wouldn't necessarily be the sort of person who'd go out with a placard arguing for equal rights for anyone, right? But I find myself, like, I in fact look down on those kinds of people because I just think everyone is a person. Like, and I the older I get, the less I care about what you look like, how tall you are, how fat you are, how thin you are, how pretty you are, what sex you are, whether you've got all your arms and legs. I don't give a shit. Certainly don't care what colour skin you got, where you come from. All I care about is whether you're a dick or not. And if you are, I won't spend any time with you. And if you're not, I'll spend all the time I can with you. That's it. No. That's the simple barometer of life, right? So for me, Gilball is quite a fun accidental expression of the fact that, you know, we have female models like Esther's, you know, and Granite, like, you know, big, you know, strong lasses. You got, you know, Brisket who has like a lovely soft kind of full belly on her, as well as like a nice big pair of boobs and a nice butt. But then you've also got, you know, people like Friday who has that kind of sort of pinch face, evil malevolent kind of look to her. We've got a broad spectrum of people, so it doesn't even resonate as anything unusual that we've got a guy called Lucky who has one arm.
Nice.
Especially in a game of football. He doesn't need his arms.
No.
Actually, I this is interesting. I've only just thought of that then. In primary school, we played against a team that had a child with no arms, and he played soccer. And
wow. Well,
yeah, and good on his parents for getting into it. Like, yeah, he was. But at that age, we're all garbage, and he was no less garbage than the rest of us.
There you go. And that's the most important thing about football. And you know, when I went, I did my coaching badges with the FA, and like the one thing that I took away from it is at that age, it's more important that the kids are enjoying themselves and fall in love with football than it is for them to be good and win and all that kind of stuff. Mm. So, yeah, fair play. Like you should not let anything stand in your way. I was chatting to a guy. I went to my dad's kind of he's like a church warden for the church in the village. And look, I'm not super religious in any way, shape or form, but my dad organises a thing which is once a month called a men's breakfast, and you go along to the church hall and they have a chef in and he cooks a big old English breakfast. You eat there, you catch up with all the other guys in the village, and they generally have a talker come in, someone, you know, very interesting. And I was chatting to this guy who came in to do a talk, guy called John Spence, who was the I think it's the CEO or the MD of Lloyds Bank, and was custodian of the merger between Lloyds Bank and TSB, which happened sort of like in the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And he actually turned around the fortunes of these two banks and moved them up the charts of you know, the big banks in England. And he did all of this over the period of 17 years while being blind, like utterly sightless. And I'm like in awe of this guy, because you're talking to him and you can tell that every single thing you're saying, every single thing that you are inflecting in your word is being catalogued away in his brain. And you get the sense that he's able to kind of recall this. And he kind of sort of said, as part of his chat, he was sort of talking about one of the cool things that you know, he's obviously being blind. He's a huge supporter of, you know, disability organizations that, you know, enable kids to like not be limited by their disabilities. And he's saying they take blind kids out in canoes in the middle of lakes and they let them go. And he said, like, and he says it's wonderful to share their experiences of all their lives, because these kids have been blind. They've kind of been indoctrined that they can't do stuff, right? And then to be taken into something that's just completely outside of their comfort zone, that demonstrates to them that there are no boundaries on your life. It doesn't matter that you're blind. You're still in a canoe in the middle of the lake. Now, good luck. Canoe yourself out of it, mate. Like, you know, and it just demonstrates their possibilities. And I was kind of, I sort of called him up on it a little bit on it. And I said, John, I said, like, whilst I kind of, I agree with what you're saying, and it's heartwarming to hear, I think more depressingly, that societal constraints are actually applied to everyone, and everyone needs to kind of realize that actually there is nothing that can stop you doing what you want to do. You know, if you work hard enough, if you're smart enough, if you're lucky enough, you've got to be in the race. You just got to buy a raffle ticket. Do you know what I mean? You got to try, and to kind of, you know, see that societal constraints are meaningless. It's cages of our own design. We create these artificial constructs that tell people you can't do shit, and they're the people I just want to say fuck you. I will try and do it. The more you say I can't do something, and if Jamie's listening to this, he is now laughing, because the more people say I can't do something, the more I want it. And the guys in the development team are really slowly learning that whole process. unless you want a really long conversation, don't ever tell me I can't do something or I can't have something, because that then becomes the one thing that my entire life is centered around. I'm nice. Such a dick sometimes.
Nice.
bit of a rambly story there, but you know, I think people are people, and it doesn't matter what size, shape, color, breed, whatever. I don't give a shit. People are people, and we try and translate that through into the products we make and the way that we approach life. So,
absolutely.
Speaking of people, specifically tiny people, and the products you make, specifically the as yet unreleased skirmish game that was sort of flagged. I think it was at Vengeance. Was it? I can't remember.
Was it Vengeance? We talked about Vengeance loosely. Yeah.
SteamyCon, I reckon you first mentioned that.
We did allude to it in SteamyCon, yeah.
I know I asked you about this last time, and it was all you could do not to, you know, spill the beans on it. But I'm going to ask you again.
Sure.
How's that tracking in broad, non-specific terms?
I enjoy your style of questioning. It's a trap.
don't tell me I can't do something, man. Don't tell me. It just makes me want to do it more.
So since we last spoke, I went over to America, and I spent a week with DC, and I took Alex, one of our senior developers, and between the three of us, we thrashed through three or four versions of the game. And what we've actually done is accidentally ended up creating two, maybe even three, really strong games that have a separate identity. So for example, one of the game ideas that we started the week with, which was the latest version of the game that I'd been working on, when we played it, it was a great game. It really was fun. It had a lot of tactical depth. It really felt, you know, like it captured the kind of, you know, the big sort of fantasy champion superhero sort of power level that we were looking at. You know, really wanted to capture that kind of cinematic, you know, high fantasy feel. But it didn't feel like a war game. It felt more like a skirmish game. And, you know, we've already got Guild Ball. We don't want to, you know, what's the point in, you know, reskinning Guild Ball? That's, you know, apart from showing a complete lack of creativity, which, you know, we certainly have no shortage of, it also runs the risk of, you know, cannibalizing our own customer base. And, you know, we end up being busy fools supporting two, three games, all of which are basically the same game and the same guys playing it. What we want to do is we want to broaden our horizons. We want to get more people to be exposed to Steamforge products and hopefully find time to enjoy them and, you know, become fans of the company and the games we make. So, you know, we kind of, well, you know, sat down and examined, well, what was it that made this feel like a skirmish game rather than a war game? And we kind of latched onto a couple of ideas. So we then rebuilt the game using these kind of new ideas and played that. And that felt perfect. That hit the money on the head. It felt like a large scale warband game that had a lot of dynamic toing and froing interactions. You were constantly engaged in the game. There was a lot of kind of tussling over objectives. There was a lot of, you know, isolated decision points that you had to make, all of which are, for me, like key tenets of good gameplay. There was a lot of kind of maneuverability. The game state was kind of changing quite a bit. And there was a lot of strategy and tactics that you had to bring to the table. So we've got these kind of two really core ideas, both of which were fun to play. One is definitely the one we're going to be focusing on first, because that is the one that creates that kind of war game, war band sort of level of feel that we want. But the other game actually fits in the game world perfectly, and that may end up being like a little 3-on-3 skirmish game. Maybe we'll bring it out as like a little board game, or, you know, something along those lines, because there was a couple of really cool mechanics in it that we really liked. So yeah, it's progressing along. Art-wise, the art style's locked down. I've got final art for a good number of the champions now, or the heroes, whatever you want to call them. Russ has done a bunch of kind of test sculpts, which we're going to get over to China to get some like test molding done, and just make sure we're getting kind of like the scaling right and stuff like that. So it's really progressing nicely. I mean, I think we've got so much stuff going on between now and November. In terms of stuff that we can talk about, you know, there's the new game that's going to be announced in the next couple of weeks, which is probably the worst kept secret in the industry right now. There's obviously the run up to SteamCon, you know, making sure as many people know what the dates are for SteamCon, and if they can make it, why they should come along. And then there'll obviously be a whole bunch of stuff, you know, at SteamCon. That we want to kind of talk about leading up to it, to sort of like pave the way for it. So I think at SteamCon is definitely going to be a time when we're going to be able to reveal a lot more about the game, probably as part of the keynote, I'd imagine. So those guys and girls who can't make it to the show physically will at least be able to kind of watch the live streams and get to share the news as it happens. And then I think once we've done that, we'll be able to kind of confidently assess what the roadmap looks like. When should we be looking to... You know, if we choose to kickstart the core game to get it up and running, when do we do that? If we're looking to, you know, release it direct to, you know, to retail, when are we going to do that? How are we going to do that? So right now the game is in a really solid state. And my next job, I'm going away on holiday on Friday, which is why I'm like slightly short of time today. So I'm trying to sort of squeeze a couple of weeks worth of work into the next 2 days, which is not working out terribly well for me. But, you know, I get a lot of pleasure and I get a lot of downtime out of just sitting there and writing. So I'm actually looking forward to clearing off as much of my kind of more boring, sensible responsibilities and freeing up some time. So when I'm on holiday, I can sit there with my laptop by the pool, chilling out, drinking a pina colada and you know, writing the rules for this game and making up characters and units and crazy effects and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to a couple of weeks of kind of just pure creative writing, to be honest with you.
Wow. Nice. And Dave's looking forward to playing it.
I am.
Oh, you should be. Like, it's... Yeah, I'm kind of... I mean, I'm our worst critic and our harshest judge, and it's definitely... The latest version that we were playing definitely had that X factor that kind of... The Gilball got at a point, and I'm like, yeah, we've got something here. And trust me, I've been working on this particular skirmish game for about 18 months now, and it's been a really hard journey, because a lot of that 18 months has been spent like in a bit of a creative wilderness where I've kind of got an awful lot of ideas, but they just aren't kind of quite connecting in the right way, and I'm not seeing that kind of magic spark. I'm now seeing that magic spark is now happening, so it's really quite an exciting time for this particular product.
Mm. Nice.
I'd be happy to read any of your drafts, Matt. Should you? I'd be very happy. Very.
Not discreet. A problem. I think. I mean, we'll definitely be looking for kind of play testers, so alpha testers. Obviously, that'll be under an NDA, which I think might preclude you guys because you make a wonderful podcast and. We try not to put people cool. into a position where there might be a conflict.
I'll quit. Let's be done. I mean, Campbell, it's yours now. Take the baby. I'm done.
That's it.
Yeah.
You're right. It'll be a hard thing to walk away from. But my God, that sounds incredibly exciting.
Well, what's going to be awesome about it is obviously now we're finding our feet again in terms of, you know, marketing and interaction with people. We've got the media program. We're able to kind of connect you with you guys much more easily now, whereas before it was a little bit kind of random ad hocness. I know Jamie's kind of talking to you guys once or twice a week via the newsletters and stuff like that. So I know that once SteamCon has been and gone, we are going to start talking about this new game, and we're going to start talking a lot about it. So we will absolutely love to come and talk more about what's going on and how the game plays and who the key movers and shakers are in it and all that kind of jazz. So, yeah, you know, expect to be involved for sure.
Awesome. Get hype. Get hype.
Nice.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, we know you're a busy man, Matt, and you have been very kind in helping us fix our initial fuck-up. So, do you have anything else you'd like to say by way of parting gesture before you go on holidays?
I don't think I do. I'm kind of just looking forward to going to South of France and drinking and eating my body weight in croissants and red wine, to be honest with you.
Best way to go.
It's terrible.
My brain's on the plane already. I had such a horrendous night last night. So we had the mother of all thunderstorms, and which is fine because, like, you can shut the windows and we've got double glazing so you don't really hear it. But the dog was going nuts. And I hadn't gone to bed till about 1:30 because I was, like, playing some League and hanging out with some mates. And then the dog woke us up at like 2:30, 3:00 and would not settle down. So I am running on fumes and green tea at the moment. I managed to get an hour's kip last night. I'm ruined.
Jeez.
So, yeah, well, you know, I've found this new... you should look this up. I don't know if you're kind of into nootropics and stuff like that, but... there's a blend of tea that I've been drinking this week, which is absolutely amazing, which is it's called titanium tea. So if you Google that, but it's basically two types of tea. One's a green tea, one's a black tea. And because the black tea is an aged tea, it's like much, much stronger than normal tea. Mm-hmm. And the green tea gives you like a shitload of antioxidants and hugely beneficial kind of bits and pieces like that. But then what you do is you gallop a load of kind of MCT oil into it and a whole like a teaspoon or a tablespoon of butter, and you blend it. So it's got a load of fats that give you like energy and instant fuel, and the MCT oil kind of triggers your body to kind of fire off all kind of ketone production. So your brain's just working on overload. It is like rocket fuel. It's like taking legal cocaine is what it's like. So if you fancy trying it, I would wholeheartedly recommend it. It's amazing.
All right. I'll look forward to that email with the recipe. I just stick to, you know, my rooibos and a little bit of matcha tea in there. But, hey, let's try some legal cocaine.
Go for it.
Nice.
I'd like to keep my teeth, so it sounds like a better alternative to the crystal meth I'm currently using.
Yeah, it's better for your complexion as well.
Well, my dentist has had words with me.
Has he?
Yes.
From the golf course. He's driving his new Ferrari. He's like, please carry on.
Yes. Yeah, crowns, root canal. We'll get you dentures. Yes. I don't know why my dentist is British. I don't know why.
Well, that's because most dentists are actually villains, and most villains are stereotypically English.
Right.
I just made that up, but it sounded plausible.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah. Look, here's the thing, right? Anyone who actually actively pursues a career in smashing people's teeth in and ripping them out of their heads and drilling them and generally causing them pain and misery and suffering is not nice, I don't think.
No. You know they do actually have one of the highest suicide rates, and it's partly to... Partly to do with the fact that they're like looking into stinky mouths all day, and also with the fact that they generally have, you know, their dentist rooms in high-rise buildings, so it's quite easy to just jump off them.
Oh, okay. Wow.
No, seriously, look that up.
But all the nitrous that they've got access to, that'd kind of take the edge off, wouldn't it? I mean, how long would you
absolutely.
Think
that?
How is your suicide rate is like linked to opportunity? Like, there's no other data point other than the fact that I apparently work in a high enough building to jump out of it. I'm therefore statistically more likely to kill myself. Wow, that's unbelievable. Gentlemen, I'm going to love you and leave you.
All right. I think that's all a good. Perfect note to end on. Thank you for your time, sir.
Yeah, thank all you. Right.
Cheers, Matt. Take it easy.
All right. See you guys.
Welcome back after that epic journey. I feel like Odysseus having returned from his epic sea voyage. I'm very tired.
Oh, sorry, I just fell asleep then.
Yeah.
Well, I got bored by my own voice. Yeah.
You fell asleep in the car, but I picked you up and I carried you into your bed and tucked you in. But yeah,
it's nice. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it's what I do, man. It's what I look out for you.
Nice. This is why we're still friends.
I know.
Yeah.
So I think it would be remiss of us not to mention Australian nationals that loom ever closer. And that'll be on the weekend of the 26th and 27th of August at 3D6 in Canberra. And that's a two-day mini-con for Gilball. It will cost you $60 to register, $50 if you pre-reg. Well, June 30 was the pre-reg date, so shit, you missed it. So $60 to register. That's going to be a good one. Matty Graham is a legend and will look after you. So get onto the Facebook page, the Gilball Australia Facebook page. All the details are pinned there at the top. We'd love to see more people attending. It's going to be a big one. Great prize. Go to Chicago if you win.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Get to meet Alex Potts.
Well, I mean, every silver lining has a cloud, right?
I love it. Got any other shout-outs, Dave?
Well, actually, yeah, I wanted to throw a shout-out to Charles Nurser, playing as part of the Byron Sanchez Cup number 3 on Vassal. It's like an international tournament played over Vassal, and played Charles Nurser in the opening round. And rarely have I met a nicer bloke. He is lovely guy. We had a very close game, and I got to say, I would play him again anytime. Really, really top bloke. So big shout out to him.
Nice one.
And how about you, Campbell?
Well, naturally, we've got to mention our sponsor, Daryl from NerdvanaGamesSA.com. He is the man that supplies our crack, our Guild Ball, and gaming crack for that matter. So anytime you're looking for something, jump on there. Daz is awesome. If you're in Adelaide, he hand-delivers it, which is legendary amongst the community here.
He's a good bloke. We are fortunate in that regard to have met so many lovely people.
And he plays a union team that look like a bunch of leprechauns, which is awesome.
That's true.
That's good.
Another episode draws to a close.
I know. If we've got anything big planned for number 20, I never thought we'd get past 5, so...
Here's what I'm thinking, right? I think we run a contest for episode 20, and we ask Twitter, what have you got to say to Alex Potts? And the best answer gets a limited edition model of some sort. Do we have a limited edition miss that we can
We play? Have a limited edition miss. It's funny you've mentioned that. Yeah. Okay, let's do that. If anyone is still listening to us on Twitter, we'll throw that out there. So,
all right, man. And we'll announce the winner as part of episode 20.
Nice. I think what we'll also do as part of the Patreon, not that I've made this official on the Patreon page, but we will periodically, probably once a month, run a bit of a raffle for the people who are subscribers. We've got models that have been donated, and you and I have won that are double ups, things like that, and we're actually just going to donate them back to the community. It's better than I don't see the point in, you know, selling things on like that. So I'd rather it goes back into the community to the people that kind of want it. So
you're all heart, Campbell. You really are.
Always heart and a shit ton of hair.
Your wife is a lucky woman.
She is.
So episode 19, we lost the tapes, we found the tapes, and ever onwards.
Nice. Done.
Thank you.
yep, 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 yep.